Hey, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Negotiation. I am your host, Todd Embley, and today's show is part two of our conversation with Ray Ma, a distinguished expert with nearly two decades of working experience in technology and finance in the U.S. and China. She is also the founder and editor of TechBuzz China, an investment newsletter and boutique media and consulting service aimed at professional investors interested in China tech. In this episode, we explore the evolving consumer tech and innovation landscape in China beyond AI. Ray shares her analysis on the rise of local life services, humanoid robotics, and China's dominance in electric vehicles, highlighting the factors propelling growth and the roadblocks that remain. We also zoom out to explore the broader dynamics between the U.S. and China's tech ecosystems. Ray discusses rising tensions, how U.S. perceptions of Chinese tech are shaped by media and policy, and whether meaningful collaboration is still possible. Finally, Ray reflects on the future of China tech and whether she still believes, as she's said before, that the next China is China. Listen for sharp insights, fresh perspectives, and a grounded look at where things might be headed. Enjoy.
Really, the main thing is because this was the only way that China was going to become an automotive leader. And automotive is a very large sector. It contributes hugely to the economy that the government cares about, that employs a lot of people. And it was just never going to become like an ICE, lead internal combustion engine leader, because all those brands are owned by foreigners, right? So in China, like the favorite phrase is 弯道超车, which means that you cut ahead by taking the outside lane, right? You go to the outside lane and then cut ahead of the cars in front of you, basically by taking a different direction. So still saying like people need mobility solutions, but hey, I'm going to use a different technology and I'm going to really go down that route. But effectively, I think we can think of the era of the ICE dominated vehicle as largely being over, because with these prices and with most of the countries in the world, not the US, not Canada, being very, very resource starved, they're going to want renewables.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to The Negotiation, brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies. Ray, welcome back to The Negotiation Podcast, again, part deux.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Okay, let's jump right back in. We will dispense with the pleasantries because we already did that an hour ago when we recorded part one. So how is China's consumer tech landscape evolving, particularly in areas like e-commerce and local life services?
I think that there has not been that much revolution really in consumer internet, especially with the two that you're talking about, largely because China's kind of made all the progress I think it can before the next technological leap, right? So already have had pretty much instant delivery for the past, really like same day for the past decade, for like 30 minute deliveries that's been happening in the last, 5 years. E-commerce has been very advanced, logistics very cheap and advanced. In fact, now the story really is just all these Chinese e-commerce companies expanding abroad, right? I would say the things that are kind of interesting, just today, again, saw that the Chinese government approved two companies for air taxis. So basically, drones. Yeah. And they've been building that out slowly. There are 100 so-called low altitude airports in China already. I think they're more like helicopter pads versus, you know, they're more like that than they are like full on airports. They're much bigger than a pad, but yeah. And you know, that's expected to double this year.
How do you air traffic control that? Or is AI? Ooh, I wonder if AI is going to take over air traffic controllers. Like that
would probably make sense. That would probably be a good idea.
Anyway,
but right now it's just very restricted areas, right? So,
yeah.
So you can take off and land in very restricted.
When you said taxis, I was thinking people.
Yes, it can hold people. Yeah, that is the intent. And then you also have, I think, the other notable. I don't know if it's that notable, but it's at least certainly interesting expansion is that after you have, you know, Shein and Temu, TikTok expand abroad and bring these short videos and live stream e-commerce and fast fashion, whatnot, into the rest of the world, now you have a relatively newer product, which is vertical dramas. So those, you know, super short, like 1-2 minute per episode serialized dramas you can watch on your phone. That's expanding here. So a Hollywood friend actually asked me about it yesterday. And then I got another like marketing company messaging me about it today. And it's been top of the app charts. So it's funny because most people don't know anyone who actually watches it because they tend to be, I don't want to stereotype, but this is the data. It's like stay-at-home moms, you know, seniors who have a lot more free time during the day and really like something soapy. But yeah, like that's a Chinese export right now. And in fact, it's become so dominated by Chinese producers and scriptwriters, and a lot of them are directly translated from Chinese, apparently, that I read again just yesterday that like it's become now a thing because these things still cost $300,000 or something to produce in the US per series, that they're even flying actors to China because they can get, you know, much more like much cheaper lighting, makeup, costumes, and even the backdrops. So like Zhuhai, you'll be surprised to hear, is like serving as a backdrop of like, you know, urban city for some of these dramas.
Place Zhuhai for me. Isn't that south out across from Hong Kong? Like,
yeah, it's very close to Hong Kong. Shenzhen.
Yeah. 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 Yep. Okay. This one's going to be fun though. And you've written about this humanoid robots. What's the status of that sector in the US and China?
Yeah, well, again, it's so early. So I think what people maybe everyone does realize is that it's very, very early. There's no one that's demonstrated any sort of general use, humanoid. We just wrote a in-depth report on Unitree, which is the company that continually goes viral for their really slick videos. And they actually just had one today where they had their H1 robot, which is their more expensive robot. I think it's like 60 or 90K. Can't remember the exact amount. And they have hands now. So they previously did not have hands, but now they have hands now. They have a video of this robot like flipping pages, turning a Rubik's Cube, etc. That being said, there are many, many challenges and limitations that have not been solved with humanoid robots, including, you know, battery life, including stability, you know, and including intelligence, right? Maybe you can program it to do things, but can it actually autonomously make decisions and interact with, you know, with new environments entirely that it hasn't been trained in before, for example? These are not problems that have been solved. So, I do think what's interesting is that a lot of people assume that China's way ahead of the US because of its prowess in manufacturing everything, right? Being the manufacturer of our iPhones and also so many advanced EVs. But human robots are actually much more complicated than that. They're much more difficult to manufacture and they are much more dependent on intelligence. right? So the way I would like to explain it is, imagine if you want to use the metaphor of cars, you're not just making EV, you're making EV with autonomous driving, right? So you need to be the manufacturer that is able to integrate both of them in order to have a truly functional human robot. That, and add to it the fact that right now, it's just too expensive for people to really buy it. The people who can afford it are industrial users, right? So factories and whatnot. You see a lot of car manufacturers attempting to have some of these robots be in pilots in their factories, but they're kind of weak still, right? Like all the problems I said before, that they're not solved. And if you think about it, bipeds, right? Standing on 2 feet isn't even, it's not the most efficient way to design a worker. It's not the most stable. It's not the most fast. It can't bear the most weight, right? A quadruped would be much more efficient, right? So there's the other side of the argument, which is that quadrupeds with wheels, so dogs, robot dogs on wheels, actually are much more efficient for all sorts of use cases and not humanoids. So my answer would be, right now, based on our industrial research, no one has gotten anything close to mass commercialization to work. So you're not getting your humanoid robot butler or maid or whatever in the next 5 years. And the U.S. is, in terms of companies that say that they are fully integrated and in terms of hardware and software, are actually in the US. So Tesla, Figure, et cetera. However, there's a big question mark around that just because we haven't actually seen what they actually look like, right? A lot of these are just roadmaps that people have shared and prototypes, but more so maybe roadmaps that, the US is quote unquote ahead. But China, I think, is going a slightly different way. China's not necessarily going the way of humanoid robots. It's just going the way of robots that work. Like I said, quadrupeds with wheels or robots that could work in factories, which are much more likely to be industrial robots, like robotic arms, than humanoids.
Okay. Thank you for that. I want to talk about something that I am generally really excited about, and I would love to be a BYD dealer owner at some point. I just fear it's never going to happen. I think there are some political headwinds, particularly one person who would never want that to come across the ocean. I want to talk about the EV market, electric vehicles. China has become, to me, a pretty clear leader outside of that one company named Tesla. What factors have driven this success, and what challenges does the industry face moving forward?
I think simplistically, it's really the fact that the technology has improved and the price has come down sufficiently where last year, I want to say it was August, the number of new EVs sold exceeded 50%. So you have more electric vehicles being sold now than gas-powered cars. With the asterisks, I believe those electric vehicles, in China, when you say electric vehicles, you are oftentimes including plug-in hybrids. So they could still be a hybrid vehicle to qualify. That being said, it's, I think, very obvious now, right, that players such as BYD, and there are a ton of EV players in China, are now really churning out quality cars, exporting them to much of the world. And they are really just, they've really completely changed the landscape of the automotive market in China, which, by the way, is the largest car market in the world. Right, for new cars and used cars. So it's just the largest in the world. The main reason for their success is that besides the technological advancements Of course, there was some government policy, but, you know, I think many, many countries had government policies that favored, give you tax rebates or whatever if you bought EVs. In China, it was, besides the rebates, it was especially attractive because you could get a license plate. As you know, in many urban areas, the license, you might have a car, but you couldn't actually drive it without a license plate. And that sometimes took a lottery. So with EVs, you could just get your car on the road. And that was very attractive. So policies like that certainly helped. And then there's also just like infrastructure, right? The charging infrastructure, power infrastructure.
Yeah,
in China. Yeah, has been upgraded a lot. And it is still expensive, though, to charge the cars. It's not like, you know, so cheap. I believe when I went in 2023 to visit my cousin who owned a Tesla Y, he said that it actually cost him more still to charge his car than to if you were, you know, going to use gas. However, that has changed over time. And I think that also varies per region. He was in, you know, the boonies somewhere. So I think that like all those things contributed, but really the main thing is because this was the only way that, you know, China was going to become an automotive leader. And automotive is a very large sector that contributes hugely to the economy, that the government cares about, that employs a lot of people. And it was just never going to become like an ICE, internal combustion engine leader, because all those brands are owned by foreigners, right? And Korean companies, Japanese companies, whatnot. So in China, like the favorite phrase is 弯道超车, which means that you cut ahead by taking like the outside lane, right? So how do you, in a race, right? You go to the outside lane and then cut ahead of the cars in front of you. And basically by taking a different direction. So still saying like people need mobility solutions, but hey, I'm going to use a different technology and I'm going to really go down that route. And then now there's also like green hydrogen as well, which I don't know nearly as much about. But effectively, I think we can think of the era of the ICE dominated vehicle as largely being over, because with these prices and with most of the countries in the world, not the US, not Canada, being very, very resource starved, they're going to want renewables.
I wish we're a little bit limited in Canada. And I would say, so you mentioned more than 50% are now EVs in China.
Of new vehicles sold.
Yeah. I would be interested to see what that data looked like as you sliced it latitudinally across China, moving north, because the terrain and the temperature, especially here in like British Columbia, where I'm very, you know, I'm right on the cusp of the Rockies right here, very mountainous, very hilly, and also gets very cold, is still quite prohibitive. I mean, I did get a new truck last summer. I looked very hard at the F-150 Lightning, the Ford Lightning, and the sales guy talked me out of it. Because he's got kids in hockey. I've got kids in hockey. We travel like all the time. And so he said, you know, when you're bombing around the mountains and going to all these places and stuff like this, like he said, it's just not, we're not there yet. It's not there for Canada. Maybe like I think there is enough charging stations around. Although, you know, booking apps that you now need to book charging stations and things ahead of time and in advance and plan. It's like booking a ferry to go across the ocean to an island or something. It's pretty funny, but still a long way to go. Yeah, not as much up here. It is definitely more a temperate climate solution by far. Still some work to do for those of us that aren't living in California, Ray.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
Go ahead.
I'm saying that's a really good point, and it's not first thing I think of because of where I live. But yeah, you can always, you know, you can get our partner Lei Xing, who is a EV expert, to expand on that. I'm sure he knows the answer.
Yeah, I follow some of these car guys on Instagram that are constantly exploring what the new vehicles are, and they come out and whatnot. And his Chinese is actually pretty good. And he's gone to China and been able to go around and test drive a bunch of them for a while. And like I said, the technology that is involves just, you know, now every seat seems like it comes out when it's got a massaging feature. You know, heating, venting, and massaging chairs are like almost pretty standard now. The full dash from driver's through passenger side is now all a screen. You know, they got the flip down screens coming down again. Everybody can game the front seats fully reclined towards the back seat, where it then becomes a bed and you can fully lie down. And, you know, coolers and then heaters. You can actually have like bottles warming for your baby in these coolers that are in the console, the middle console. I mean, just all these little luxury conveniences. It's pretty amazing what they're coming out with. So ICE for me for now, but very soon hope to be able to enjoy them and then watch the price of electricity go through the roof. How do you perceive current American public and governmental attitudes towards Chinese technology companies? This is a kind of a big question. And then I know it's going to be a little bit political, but what factors have influenced those perceptions?
Well, I think it's very obvious that the two countries do not have an amicable relationship, are in at least what's considered probably an economic war. I think that, yeah, the American perception is still that Chinese companies are unreliable, shady, you know, not to be trusted, directly piping data to the Chinese government for whatnot. And, you know, not all of those perceptions are unfounded, certainly. I think that for the IP theft, though, what I think has been really interesting is that because of, you know, DeepSeek, because of Unitree, all of a sudden you have Silicon Valley having this collective freak out that like, oh, China is actually ahead now in all these, you know, different disciplines. If you have been watching China like I have for the last, you know, decade plus, I wouldn't necessarily say China's ahead in, you know, like staggeringly ahead in so many industries, but they've just made such solid progress that like the metaphor I like to use is like, you know, many people did not look at China tech at all. And I'm talking tech broadly, including deep tech, including biotech space, whatnot, for the last 10 years. And it's like, if you last saw your friend's child and they were like a 2-year-old, but now it's been 10, 15 years, and you realize they're like a high potential high school grad, you know, participating in the International Math Olympiad, and your impression of them is that they were still in diapers. And yeah, of course. But, you know, has China like just flown so far beyond the orbit of everyone else in technology? No, I don't think so. Right. So, but there, because there's that jarring effect where, because they haven't taken notice and they're only looking, you know, 10 years later, there's an overcorrection. So people now are all of a sudden like, oh, every tech out of China is like magical. They're so far ahead. We just like, we're generations behind now. And I don't think that's true either. I think the truth is somewhere in the middle, right? China's pretty good at certain things that it's scaled up well and where it has the right market. And therefore is able to create the space for the right ecosystems to thrive. And it hasn't done so well in certain other things because it doesn't need to.
If you step back, you know, for you and I, we've lived in China for significant amounts of years, understand the culture, you, of course, a lot more than I think. You have to understand that China is not they're not the Borg, to use the Star Trek New Generation term. You know, they're not this collective that is just charging forward. They have their own issues as all countries do. They are facing a aging population issue, right? They are still dealing with a housing crisis. They are still dealing with, they have a lot of other things that they have to carry, just like every other adulting country out there has to deal with. And so, yes, there's a lot of answers and things like that. But, you know, they're still a normal country, just like all others, and have a lot of things that they also have to deal with. I just have this feeling that when I talk to people over here about China, if they've never been, that they think almost like China is this alien race that is just like a super being or something that is only, they have everything figured out and they're just racing ahead or something like that. And I'm like, they still have encumbrances.
Yeah. Humans don't act like that, right? Get like five people in a group and try to order lunch and, you know, you'll have like more discussion than necessary. So yeah, I think like what China has done well in is figured out a system of incentives that work in promoting certain things. And then, by the way, many of those incentives also fail, and then having a system to correct it when things really go, you know, not according to plan. But sometimes the second order effects take a while to show up, and, you know, you could be really far down the road before you realize, hey, I have to pull back, or that thing, that growth I was chasing. So real estate's a really good example, right? China had a kind of a real estate, you know, in many markets, a bubble. And then to pull it back is very, very painful, right? So it's not just like, should I pull it back? But how do I pull it back without really pissing off everyone else and then also causing, you know, massive unemployment or failures of, you know, lenders and whatnot, construction companies, like bondholders, so many stakeholders. How do I unwind certain decisions? And how do I keep to the middle path, right? A lot of things you need it, but you just don't want an excess of. So everything in moderation. But it's really hard to modulate that precisely, especially in a large nation, and especially when you have many competing priorities.
Yeah. I mean, real life comes from us all, and it's coming for you in about 13 minutes with regards to your child pickup. So we have to get moving. Yeah. I do want to touch on media portrayal and how, you know, you're not insulated because you deal with a lot of people from, and of course the newsletter you put out, you get a lot of general public interaction and feedback as well. But I know that the media portrayals on both sides contribute to the biases, right? Against both sides, technology and otherwise, and the professionals. How do you think that these narratives can be addressed or corrected on both sides?
I think that, yes, there are some things, right? Like, hey, you should talk to, you know, people who actually know the market, right? So in the case of Chinese people, maybe talk to Silicon Valley insiders versus just, you know, some Chinese national that's based here. And similarly, the reverse, right? So if you want to know about China tech, I think we are a good source, but that's really because we really rely on the ground sources over there. You know, I'm not like just making up based on, you know, very few, my own circle friends or, you know, very heavily biased data. That being said, I am not optimistic that there will ever be super neutral narratives about anything, because that's just not the way the human mind works, right? Going back to what you said the last episode about Dave saying that the most important things to teaching your kids, how humans behave. Well, we're just like laden with cognitive biases. And there's just no way to get rid of them. We can try to minimize them, but they're always going to be there. And at some point, you have diminishing returns. Now, I don't think we're at all near the point of diminishing returns. I think there are many things we can do to make that gap between reality and perception smaller. But I honestly think that for many people, if it is not like their work, they're just not incentivized to, it's much easier to go with a narrative that simplifies how the world works in their mind. And I would say that even for investors whose sort of decisions and, you know, truth-seeking abilities you would think, manifest in their returns. I'm not really sure that, like, that, you know, dedication to truth seeking is as deep as it could be.
Agreed. I think, you know, avoiding buying into mainstream media is probably just very, very wise at this point. Never more so. And be aware and start to embrace how wrong you are and have been about most things that you think or have thought. I think the earlier you realize how wrong you can be and how fallible that we are as humans, even having our opinions given and developed for us, the faster you become wise. I think that's really just what aging is. And where the wisdom comes from. Okay, I'm going to jump into one more thing. You have long been relatively bullish on China compared to other analysts. And I'm going to say that I didn't say that, but that's what I'm being asked to ask you. But I agree that you are very bullish. You're very positive. Let's say that. And I think a lot of analysts that I typically watch are seemingly positive. That's what I would rather say. So if we say the next China is China, does that still hold true?
Yeah, that's an article. That's the title of an article I wrote.
What?
A few years ago. Yeah, the next China is China. But I stole that from my friend who was a VC, you know, a famous VC in China. And what I would say is, I still think that's largely true. Now, in the context in which I said that a few years ago, it was really in terms of like new startups to fund. And it was really in the light of, this was pre-AI. So it was really consumer-facing startups, you know, new marketplaces, like new ways to create, you know, social companies. I think that with all these new deep tech companies emerging out of China, it's not even accurate to say that the next China is China, because China wasn't known for such, you know, deep tech before. So China has actually just become, you know, China has iterated on itself, and it is now China 2.0 versus, you know, trying to find another China 1.0. So I guess the story has changed. I don't know what is a concise or snappy way of putting that sentiment into, you know, the next China is China is really snazzy. But yeah, I don't know how to put that put that new sentiment into words.
It doesn't mean is that the next China is some other country.
I think if you're talking about China, you know, quote unquote China 1.0, where you know, a lot of the sort of it's like solving developing country problems, right? Getting infrastructure in, getting abundance of goods and services in front of people. I would say then that China is just exporting those abilities now, right? You see Chinese entrepreneurs, again, it's changed a little bit with AI, with a lot of entrepreneurs being sucked into this new technology. But I would say pre-AI, for sure, that was the trend, you know. Take whatever is available in China and then exporting it elsewhere, whether that be consumer internet apps or, like, you know, better grid infrastructure and better solar and better charging infrastructure so you can sell more EVs.
Okay, old friend, where can we, and by we, I mean everybody listening and or watching, where can we follow your writing and your commentary? Where are you living out there? And by the way, I appreciated you called it Twitter, not X, by the way. So where can everybody follow and absorb all your wisdom?
Thank you. The limited wisdom I have to dispense can be found at techbuschina.substack.com. That's our newsletter. I don't write most of it, but we have really great writers on e-commerce, internet, and then also because we have really great content partners that give us sort of proprietary insights And now we do a lot more EV, AI, et cetera. And I am generally quite active on Twitter. My handle is RUIMA, which is just my full name. And I'm going to try to do more on other platforms as well. But yeah, those are the two primary places.
You got kids now.
I know.
You're a mama. That takes a
lot
of time.
I'm doing a lot more research and hopefully doing more content on education and AI. That's like sort of my passion at the moment.
I bet it is because of said little humans under development.
Dependencies, yes.
Yes. Yep. Okay. All right. Well, Ray, thank you so much for coming on the show. As usual, this is like your fourth time. Thank you very much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Todd.
So from everybody listening, don't forget that we are on the YouTube channel, WPIC's YouTube channel, for those of you watching on video and you need your eyes and your hands for other things. You can go listen to the podcast on any of your favorite podcast platforms. Please feel free to get in touch with us, podcast@WPIC.co, and we will be sure to get back to you. We're always looking for interesting guests or topics or feedback or advice from anybody out there. It really helps if you guys go and give us a nice review, maybe give us 5 stars. It just helps feed those algorithm monsters that help us get more content like this out in front of more people. But from me and from Ray and from everybody at the negotiation team, thank you very much for listening and or watching, and we will see you next time.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@WPIC.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.